Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. On September 11th of this year, communities, cities around the country paid homage to those that died in the terrible tragedy that occurred with the Twin Towers in New York City. This is something that we don't ever want to forget. And believe me, those families that, well, experienced the loss of their loved ones will never, ever forget it. But so many questions evolved immediately after the event occurred. And that is what we're going to be discussing today. Author Ray McGinnis has put out a publication called Unanswered Questions: What the September 11th Families Ask and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. This is a very profound read, and it is one that brings up even more questions than I think was anticipated after the event itself. Ray McGinnis, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Great to be speaking with you, Donna.
Well, thank you very much. Ray, when I went through your book, I have to tell you that there was a deep sense, not just of sadness, but also a sense that in many ways, so many people that were engaged in the research, including the commission on this, there was so much that was ignored. And you bring these details out. What prompted you to really dig for the information that you share in your book, Unanswered Questions? And how long was it for you in your investigation to be able to compile all of the details, the, let's say, misconceptions, lack of communication that went on, the confusion, the political turmoil? So much of what you portray in this book is so detailed, and people can check on this if they want. What motivated you to do this, and how long did it take you to put it all together?
Well, I think, although I have written one book earlier called Writing is Sacred about the Psalms and journal writing and poetry, I have to be called the unexpected author when it comes to writing unanswered questions, because on September 11th, I was in Joshua Tree National Park in southeastern California at a retreat setting with 60 Americans from across 20 states, and I heard about the attacks from a leader of the retreat. All of us who were gathered together heard this. There was no radio, no TV, so I just heard about it verbally, and then I wasn't able to leave the United States because no planes could fly in American airspace for a number of days. And so I got back home on a bus from Seattle 5 days later up to Vancouver, Canada. And then life went on, and the news was about the Afghan war, the Iraq war. If there was much news covered about the 9/11 Commission itself, it just wasn't on the radar up here in Canada. I did happen to see about 15 minutes of Condoleezza Rice's testimony, but then I was called to dinner at the friends I was visiting with that night and didn't hear about the report even when it came out. And so I was surprised in 2007 when I was in the middle of a book tour up here in Canada. I found a book. I was looking to read a new book. I had 10 days more in my book tour, and I found a book in an airport bookstore called Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow by Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ron had died in the South Tower. And I was really surprised to start reading that book, because all I knew about the families was the reprinted obituaries from the New York Times in the Vancouver Sun, people reading the names of their loved ones on a number of years of anniversaries, and a few features on some of the remarkable people who lost their lives that day. But I didn't know anything at all about families who had then decided to catalyze their grief and go to Washington, D.C. to make the nation safe and learn whatever lessons they could from an investigation. So I was surprised that after 6 years, I wouldn't know a thing about that. But in answer to your question about how long it took, at the time that I read Christian Breitwiser's book in 2007, I wasn't thinking of writing a book at all. I did start to go to the Family Steering Committee's website, which is still up today, and I started to read through their hundreds and hundreds of questions. I read through their press releases, nearly 50 of them, during the duration of the 9/11 commission. And then in 2010, my dad got multiple myeloma, which is cancer of the red blood cells. So whatever I was thinking of maybe starting to write, I just set aside for the next 3.5 years, and didn't really, after my dad died in 2014 and was the executor of the state, it was not until 2015 that I started to really look at the questions a lot more. So I would say the seed of the idea began about 12 years ago, but a lot of the writing happened in the last 6 years.
You've dedicated this book to the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Independent Commission, as well as all others who lost colleagues and loved ones on September 11th, and ask questions to make our nation safe. This is something that is in the foremost thinking of many Americans, and that is, when this event occurred, it absolutely did not seem to make any sense. I recall talking with a number of people that I knew that said, this isn't right. I heard comments about there were multiple explosions. Well, the Twin Towers were huge buildings, absolutely huge. And when the planes flew into the first tower, I think it just absolutely stunned everyone. But the fact that there were the plans for the second tower being hit, and then the plane being hijacked and being hit in hitting the Pentagon, all of this goes on, and people start saying, how could this happen in the United States? How could we, with supposedly the national security level that we've got at that time, why wasn't this detected? What was missing? And this is what your book addresses. When you started contacting the families, the response and openness of their conversation with you, what was it like?
Well, I got to speak to some family members, and not others, because some are not answering calls from authors or the media at all. But it's a heightened sense of, this is a really important conversation I'm about to have with this person, because I probably will never speak to them again, although in some cases I am in further correspondence. And so I had to think about, what would it be like for them? As I began the conversation, here they are talking to a total stranger from another country who's asking them about their own personal losses and their own questions and their own take on the 9/11 Commission and where they are now. And so it was, it was an honor to be able to speak to them or to speak to some of the first responders. And they have, a variety of questions, many years later. And so it was, and they're also not all on the same place. There are some family members that are from the moment the 9/11 Commission report came out in 2004 in July. They said, well, this is good enough for me. And they've carried on satisfied with the official explanations. So there's a range of voices that I had to carefully showcase in my book.
Yes, and that is very significant. There's a comment in your book by Stephen Push, I believe it's, he said this. He said, this commission should point fingers. I'm not suggesting you find scapegoats, but there were people in responsible positions who failed us. We ask questions, these particular questions that we have for all Americans, for all the people who may be the next victims of terrorism. And this is something that comes up frequently in the news. We hear about attacks being done in Europe. We have had some that have been stopped here in the United States, others that have happened. And I was surprised because I was unaware of the time factor after the event that after September 11th occurred, the government, the politicians in the positioning of making decisions only agreed to authorize an investigation 14 months afterwards. That, to me, was really a surprise, because with the tremendous effect it had, you would have thought an investigation would have been started immediately. So many of these questions that the families had, when I'm reading through your material, unanswered questions, I'm going, these are totally logical. This must have really been quite astonishing to you.
Well, it is a really astonishing story. I mean, the story that, you know, a different book title, if things had gone differently, would be From Grief to Adoration, a story of families that lost loved ones. They go to Washington, D.C., like Mr. Smith goes to Washington. The politicians speedily do what they need to do and do the right thing, have a thorough, transparent investigation, and make some sensible recommendations, and it's a slam dunk. But instead, it's a story of stonewalling. Max Cleland was on the 9/11 commission, and he resigned in November of 2003, and he said that the stonewalling and sort of sabotaging of the commission, you know, giving it only $3 million to do its investigation when investigations into the Clintons with Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky were somewhere between $60 and $70 million. Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, testifying before the 9/11 commission, said, why is it that in 1986, on January 26th, Ronald Reagan government, the Challenger space shuttle tragedy happened, and numbers of people died in a space shuttle, and 5 days later, they got an investigation started. And yet here with the sitting president, with a loss of nearly 3,000 lives, there's great resistance. Vice President Cheney is telling Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to quash any effort for an investigation in the Senate, telling the press that they don't have the resources, that it would be a distraction from the war on terror. And if there was an investigation, it would give comfort to the terrorists, which just doesn't make sense to the families.
Absolutely true. What I found very interesting is that after the commission report was released, when they went through everything, all of the pages, and what was it, over 500 pages? 70% of their questions, thousands. I didn't actually know the exact number. But 70% of their questions were never asked of the people that were given testimony. And only 9% of their questions were satisfactorily answered. So you look at that information, and it's in black and white, and yet, even today, it is not brought up at all. You don't, at least I haven't heard very much of a commentary on this, and it saddened me to find out that the media even mocked the families that were demanding the investigation. It just seems like it was a drama that It sounds like a soap opera.
Well, it does. You have families like Patty Casaza, who voted, one of the numbers of families on the Family Steering Commission who voted for President Bush, the Bush-Cheney ticket, and she said that she thought, you know, she's a nursing student at the time, she thought, you know, now widowed with a son, thought that since she voted for the president, that he would be their strongest advocate, but she said he turned out to be one of their biggest adversaries. And when Stephen Push is asking about, like, you know, people that, you know, there are people that need to be, you know, held responsible. An example of this is Michael General, I forget the exact title in the military, but General Michael Canavan, and he's the hijack coordinator for all of the U.S. military. And on the day, it happened coincidentally that he was off on a trip to Puerto Rico. Now, I've worked in a head office before, and I know that if the director of my department or the head of the whole organization was out of town for some reason, they always named an acting director to step in while they were gone to be in charge of their caseload, of their profile. And so it seems that it would only make sense that somebody else would have been appointed on the day that Canavan was off to Puerto Rico. But who knows if he ever did that at all. It's just, these kinds of gaps are just confounding for the families.
You have many different family members that you have mentioned in the book. There was one woman, Carrie Lamax, said it was a media circus. After the event, the families that lost husbands, sons, cousins, nephews, uncles, aunts, mothers, I mean, 3,000 people, that's a lot. And then the families were harassed by the media. They were, if they saw them crying, they were going to film it. It really didn't give, the media did not give too much respect to the families. And this is so sad because this was a huge, huge tragedy for our nation.
And the focus of so much of the media, from what I've heard families say, was, let's get somebody who lost their family member, husband, wife, son, daughter, mother, father. Let's get up close and ask them questions so they start crying in front of us so we can roll the tape and put it on the news. Donna Marsh O'Connor, whose daughter Vanessa Lang Langer died, said, in Buffalo that the media wanted to hear just about the heartbreaking story of her daughter dying. She was pregnant at the time, 5 months. And what a wonderful person she was, but they didn't want to hear any of her questions. And so it seemed that there was a narrative that the media wanted to focus on just for the general public consumption, which was about, isn't it sad, isn't it tragic, but not to deal at all with the questions. And the questions that the families asked, I think about them as I was writing this book, when Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ron died, and others went to speak before the joint 9/11 inquiry for the Congress and Senate in September 2002, which is a precursor to the 9/11 Commission, and she is speaking to them, and people like Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona, Democrat Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, are listening and applauding their sensible, urgent, pertinent questions. And so was everybody else on the Congressional Intelligence and Senate Intelligence Committees. And yet years later, these same questions would be mocked or derided. They had, when you talk about the treatment by the media, Patty Casaza says she thought that the media would regard with, great admiration their efforts. And yet Ann Coulter would say that in response to families asking questions and the Jersey girls, as they were known, that these women were, by asking questions, that they were, quote, dancing on their husband's graves. Bill O'Reilly suggested that Patty Kasaza, Mindy Kleinberg, Lori Van Auken, and Kristen Breitwiser should pose nude for Playboy.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Good. That's unconscionable. Absolutely unconscionable. Now, Carrie Lee Mack, she had contacted George Williams, the president of the largest Pan Am family organization. His son died. His son's name was Gordy, on the terrorist attack on the Pan Am flight. And the Pan Am families had lobbied the U.S. government to change the laws that prevented victims from suing foreign nations or individuals from foreign nations who were responsible for the acts of terrorism. And she got some advice from George Williams that really was significant. These were women that they're not lawyers. They are women that are saying, we have lost loved ones here. We need to know why. Our security system in the United States, along with a number of other questions, why it failed, why they were not seen. How could this occur in a nation that's supposed to have one of the top security systems in the world? What was the advice that George Williams gave her?
Yeah, an example of that, I mean, in the testimony of Mindy Kleinberg, I mean Carrie Lee Mack, let me just add, too, was one of the people with her forming the families of September 11th, which was one family group among dozens and dozens that were being formed, because you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of family members. Just think about all the people that you or I have in our own phone book, all of the people who are immediate family, cousins, relatives, as well as friends. And suddenly, just that one person who maybe has, you know, 100 people in their extended family or close friends who knew them, colleagues at work, are all affected by that one person. So you've got thousands and thousands of families that start forming different family groups. And when Carrie Lee Mack went to a victim compensation fund meeting, because the government had, in Congress, was discussing a bailout package of $15 billion, I think, for the airlines, United and American, in September of 2001. And somebody in Congress said, hey, wait a minute, this is going to look bad if we don't also offer the families something. And so at one of those meetings, Carrie Lee Mack got permission to get a pen and paper and go around to people, and she started getting names of other people, and that was one of the groups that started to form. And then Mindy Kleinberg, speaking early on in March of 2003, before the 9/11 Commission on the first day of hearings, said, with regard to the 9/11 attacks, it has been said that the intelligence agencies have to be right 100% of the time, and the terrorists only have to get lucky once. This explanation for the devastating attacks of September 11th, simple on its face, is wrong in its value, because the 9/11 terrorists were not just lucky once. They were lucky over and over and over again. Is it luck that aberrant stock trades were not monitored? Is it luck when 15 visas are awarded based on incomplete forms? Is it luck when airline security screening allows hijackers to board planes with box cutters and pepper spray? Is it luck when emergency Federal Aviation Administration and NORAD protocols are not followed? Is it luck when a national emergency is not reported to top government officials on a timely basis? To me, luck is something that happens once, but when you have this repeated pattern of broken protocols, broken laws, broken communication, one cannot still call it luck.
Very profound, and the questions and the comments that follow with that are just very, very seriously making a statement. Something is very, very wrong within the United States security system, what's happening. And, you know, you mentioned the compensation package and the firefighters, the police. paramedics, the people that were on ground, I mean, ground zero, trying to rescue people, doing all kinds of things. I did an interview recently with one of those men, and he has ended up with cancer. Almost every one of those people that was in that environment doing rescue work of one kind or another have ended up with cancer because of the toxic fumes, everything else, and who knows how many other people in that area at the time have same kind of side effects. So they said, and it really was quite something to read, first responders have to beg, crawl, and plead. And there were 83,000 first responders. And it took forever for legislation to be passed to be able to give any kind of medical compensation to these people. Because within a very short period of time, many of them were seriously ill.
Well, all of the the buildings that came down were full of asbestos and many other toxins. And the head of the Environmental Protection Agency said that it was safe to breathe the air down there, which was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got people issuing statements to the public, people in key leadership positions seemingly doing the opposite of what they should be doing. You have politicians in Washington, D.C. On the one hand, every year September 11th happens, they cheer and regard with highest esteem and highest accolades the efforts of the, quote, heroes of 9/11, and at the very same time withhold financial aid to deal with their health effects, cancers and other things, and other disabilities. Just like the 9/11 Commission, which received the families having done their homework and read through thousands of mainstream news articles and said, here are the questions we think are most relevant to ask these people in the Bush White House cabinet or these different agencies. The 9/11 commissioners told the press at the beginning of the whole investigation that the families' questions were, quote, a roadmap for how to do the investigation. Then, as you say, at the end of it, they only seriously looked at 9% satisfactorily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what they were trying to bring attention to, and you mentioned this earlier, is NORAD, the CIA, the FBI, the airlines, the Port Authority, the City of New York, the FAA, Secret Service, the U.S. military, and those in senior positions of leadership. This was really huge. And I'm sure it was quite a shock that this small group of women were standing up and speaking out, and yet they kept trying to close them down. In fact, you make the comment about Dick Cheney, that he was the principal attack dog on the Independent Commission with an extreme and vitriolic assault. And I was stunned to find out that the September 11 Victim Compensation Fund, the VCF, that's the abbreviation for it, during Christmas of 2001, was laid out. But there was a term in that you could not sue the alleged Saudi funders of terrorism related to the attacks. This is our government saying, you have no rights. We are telling you this is not to be done. And the question would be, why not? They turn around and sue the United States. Why is it we could not go after them?
Yeah, it's absolutely perplexing to family members who have one thing in common, a loss of a loved one, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or Independent, and they've watched successive Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations stonewalling and whether the FBI or the Department of Justice standing with the Saudi government in courts before judges against the family's efforts to have a lawsuit. In 2020 April, William Barr, Attorney General, told a judge that the classified documents could not be released. Or even others that were declassified but couldn't be entered in court regarding the family's lawsuit against the Saudis because it would damage state secrets and would also harm American national security. And for the families, they're thinking, well, how is it that our suing a foreign government, in this case Saudi Arabia, regarding a case of possible complicity in the attacks, how could our suing a foreign nation harm American national security? It just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Also, there were those in America that were really following different details quite closely. There's an independent investigator that you mentioned, Paul Thompson, and he's got a website. And his website is loaded with all kinds of articles. And much of your information and the information that was gathered by the women actually came from media. And they found so many discrepancies that it was astonishing. And you would think that someone would say, well, if we have this many discrepancies, we need to pay attention here. But that's not what happened.
No, the discrepancies are at so many levels. Their family members and the family steering committee that accept at least the bare bones of the official story of Bin Laden, the 19 hijackers. But nonetheless, Mary Fetchett will say, well, my son Brad would have got out of the South Tower, but the speaker system in the towers are telling all of the people, even those who are running down the stairs being met with people in bullhorns, saying, this is America. Go back to your desk. You are safe. If you leave your desk, you'll be fired. And it doesn't make sense when people across the nation, across the world, who've ever been to on a job in a building, have probably had to have a fire drill a couple times a year just to make sure that you know what to do if there's an actual fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I worked in a 9-story building in Toronto, Canada, we did that twice a year. We knew who the fire captain was on our floor. And it wasn't the case that if I was on the 6th floor in a certain section of that floor and knew that there was the fire going on in the 7th floor, I could just relax and stay at my seat. I would have been told to get out of the building. And so when the families learned that CIA Director George Tenet is at the St. Regis Hotel on the morning of September 11th having breakfast, and he's on a phone call that starts at 8:50 a.m., 4 minutes after the North Tower is hit. And into that phone call, two or three or 5 minutes into that phone call, he tells the people he's on the phone with in CIA headquarters that he is 100% certain that the plane in the North Tower represents a terrorist attack by Osama bin Laden. Well, for family members who learned that information, they're thinking, well, why didn't the CIA director, certain that that was the case, have somebody at the CIA headquarters phone the Port Authority and tell them it's a terrorist attack, evacuate the buildings? It just makes sense to do that.
And it wasn't done. Discrepancies in timelines between statements made by NORAD, the FAA, the White House, and others. This is, you think of the, I'm pausing because this is quite, to be perfectly frank, quite an emotional read when you go through it. Because the dishonesty that is very apparent, the political positioning of we are not going to tell the American people the truth because we have made tremendous errors. Why there is so much secrecy and why there is this attitude that the American people are dumb, that they cannot deal with reality, is beyond me. Like I said, it was a very emotional read for me because this opened up a whole venue of information that I had no idea about, which I'm sure that there are millions of Americans that maybe even have the same questions in the mind, but they go, well, our government wouldn't do that to us. Remember, governments are run by people, and people are making these decisions. And if it were you, or me, then we would be held accountable more than likely. Why should they be exempt from being held accountable for the behaviors? One of the points that you bring out is that Kissinger was supposed to be heading this commission. And there was just a huge uproar because his connection with, you know, the various people. And one of the women even had a meeting with him. And when she asked if he had a connection with the Osama bin Laden family, he got all nervous and canceled the meeting. And it didn't last any time at all. His response was very obvious that, yes, he did have a connection. They went some way. Some members of that family were in his circle of clients. And yeah, fortunately, so he wasn't
like
made
a very
that.
Odd decision to have the president name first name someone who has a business associates by the name of bin Laden to investigate an attack which is allegedly perpetrated by the prime suspect. It just doesn't make sense.
It's a conflict of interest.
Yes.
So you don't do that. It's like the government having to do an investigation on itself. That has never worked very well. History has shown that.
I think that one of the challenges, I mean, I certainly, it was emotional for you. It's been emotional for me. I catch myself unexpectedly at times getting emotional, even some of these interviews, and writing the book. And I would be watching different family members' testimony on C-SPAN before the 9/11 Commission, or in other symposiums and events before the press. When I remember there, after the 9/11 Commission is over in the winter in December of 2004, and the families are just starting to say, well, whatever we think about the omissions of the commission report, let's at least pass these recommendations regarding security and safety. And yet there's all kinds of stonewalling on the part of the White House, on the part of the Congress. Henry Kissinger and some other people are saying that they don't think it's wise to go ahead and pass any legislation regarding recommendations just yet, but we need to sort of take more time to think it over. And Mindy Kleinberg was, I think it was around on the anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor, I think, on the 7th of December 2004, a number of family members, Carrie Lee Mack and some others, were near the White House, and reporters were speaking to them. And Mindy Kleinberg says, it just doesn't make sense. I spoke to people on the 9/11 Commission, and they said that the reason why we were attacked on September 11th was because, quote, nobody was in charge.
That's a fabulous statement to make.
Well, it's astonishing. And for family members that look around their meal table each day and see one less person there, it's just not good enough.
It isn't good enough. It isn't good enough. And it is, again, a very sad statement about a lot of things that are even being reflected upon today, that there is not that integrity. And that is something that I think has affected Americans and people even around the world wondering about all of the hype about, gee, we have transparency, and there isn't transparency at all, and there's not the answers that need to be given because there are all of these political agendas that individuals are engaged in. One of the individuals on the commission, it was a vice chairman, Lee Hamilton, the politicians themselves said that this man should not be put in the vice chairman positioning of that commission because of his attitudes. He wasn't an investigator. He wasn't going to question if one of his buddies was going to say, I didn't do anything. That would be it. That's it. This person gave me their word. I trust him, and we're not even going to question them. That is not an investigation at all. That was appalling to me.
No. When he was involved in the, he was sitting on the Iran-Contra inquiry, and he said, You know, I talked to Oliver North, and he gave me my word that he was telling the truth. It's important that people investigating events like September 11th or the Iran-Contra inquiry or Watergate earlier on are people who are going to notice when someone is lying to them. If you're always expecting that anybody who's speaking with you is, of course, going to tell you the truth, you're not the right person to be doing, leading the investigation. Hamilton didn't want any subpoenas. He didn't want anyone swearing under oath. He thought that public hearings were, quote, dangerous. So
no.
That doesn't help. It undermined the confidence of the families early on with someone like Lee Hamilton, who was a longtime best friend and often taking vacations with the Dick Cheney and Lynn and Donald Rumsfeld and his spouse.
There was an executive director, Zelikow, that was appointed, and this man was really empowered with an agenda that he closed down so many things and manipulated. He was like a dictator, and people were not allowed to ask questions. This was really... I just shook my head when I was reading this. I thought, how can this person even be permitted to hold that positioning? Why was it so difficult to find someone that would be a real good investigator, but it wasn't wanted? That was not wanted, really, because there's other things going on.
And this is one of the things I had to learn, who is Philip Zelikow? You're writing articles or books about former President Kennedy during the Cuba crisis, and people who are reviewing his book saying he is citing sources, documents, memos, press statements by the president, and turning them 180 degrees backwards to what they actually meant, and writing a history which is really a false revisionism. And then he's also involved in having written a co-authored book with Condoleezza Rice, and also significantly involved in authoring the policy for preemptive war against Iraq. And it's Lori Van Auk, whose husband Kenneth died in the North Tower, says that she called Executive Director Zelikow on it when he's scheduling all the people coming forward to speak at the public hearings. And the first couple of days of public hearings include several people who are speaking to the 9/11 Commission all about Iraq having attacked America on September 11th. Zelikow was, she said that Zelikow was trying to give a sales pitch for the Iraq war. Here's all this attention on Iraq having attacked America, and Zelikow is steering the commission by ordering staff to not investigate anything about Saudi Arabia. So he's really wanting to frame the whole 9/11 report with a bias that Iraq attacked on.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, but where there was a person working in this man's office that kept records on every single phone call. That was the protocol that this man received and the calls that he made. And he was making calls to people that he should never have been making calls to, discussing all kinds of things. And he absolutely told her to stop doing the telephone log, but she kept it up anyway on the advice of someone. She was very concerned because she felt that he was misrepresenting the very ethics that this commission was supposed to uphold.
Yes, Heidi Hottaker, I think is her name, and she had a good history, a resume, having worked in several U.S. embassies in Europe, and she was doing what she knew to do as a professional. And so when she found out that a senior White House counsel, Karl Rove, was leaving numbers of phone calls, she was concerned about that, as were other staff, that got the impression, as they worked with Philip Zelikow, as he told them not to look at this thing or only to look at that thing, that it seemed that the direction of the 9/11 Commission report, that there was a a priority that whatever the commission report published, that it would not damage or embarrass the president or harm his reelection chances. And that, in the view of the families, should not be the priority for how the commission report does its investigation or reports at the end.
There were numbers of people, men and women both, that were right there when the explosions occurred. And I'm using the word explosions as an emphasis over the planes hitting. That the planes hit the tower, everybody saw that. But there was one explosion right after the other. And this is something I recall vaguely, a commentary by one or two different individuals, who they were, I do not recall, but saying something was wrong with the reports that were coming out because there were multiple explosions, detonations that went on in the building, and there were people that the buildings, and there were people that reported that, and yet it was totally ignored.
Yes, Patty Casaza, whose husband John died in the North Tower, he told her he loved her, and tell our son John Jr., I love him, and he also told her that he believed there were bombs going off up, 104th, 105th floor of the North Tower. And the report about explosions wasn't, there was no investigation into that by the 9/11 Commission, although the Fire Department of New York had, having lost 343 first responders, had 503 of those who did the rescue and lived to tell about it, come and speak to their senior staff, often with FBI presence, in a series of audio taped interviews in the fall, winter of 2001-2002. And of those 503 first responders, 118, certainly well over 100, volunteered in the course of their testimony that they had witnessed what they say are explosions or bombs or secondary devices going off, describing things like I was, one firefighter talked about being blown up into the air and hurled 40 feet across a hallway on a certain floor. Another one witnessed somebody trying to exit one of the Twin Towers, and that person suddenly gets blown across the street to the boulevard, which is different than someone being on fire and running across the street to a boulevard. So the descriptions are quite vivid and difficult and disturbing to read, and I had to read through all 12,000 pages of it. I took one first responder a day for 16 and a half months. But it's quite the collective testimony is quite compelling that there were explosions as far as the firefighters were concerned. And Fire Engineering Magazine, in their 2002 editorial in January, raised questions about this too. And they wouldn't have done that if they were out of line, because it's a magazine read by the Fire Department of New York employees. So, President Bush said in September 2006 that he thought that maybe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had assigned several al-Qaeda terrorists to plant bombs in the building. If the bombs represent some sort of a massive failure of security, that's bad enough, and if it's something else, then that's also really bad. But the 9/11 Commission, certainly with the FBI present in many of these first responder interviews with the Fire Department of New York, would have known about them, but instead chose to ignore almost all of their testimonies and didn't ask them to come forward and tell them what they knew.
Missing accounts. There are so many points of information that just were given, and then things would disappear. And you have all of this that's going on. Also, there was the question brought up by the women. How did the planes get past radar that were supposedly going to be recognized. There's just so much that goes into that question box, and yet the lid keeps getting slammed down. What do you think it is going to take to be able to eventually get the truth? Are we going to have to wait 50 years?
Well, I never know. There's that story of the 100th monkey, which I don't know that well, but I get the impression that at some point there's an evolution with the 100th monkey. And so I think that just ordinary citizens, ordinary individuals, whether they are family members themselves that still have questions or other ordinary American citizens, start a conversation, you know, look up something. I mean, Sarah Van Auken, whose father, Kenneth, died, she went to Pennsylvania and got a college degree in the arts and drama, and she put on a play called This Is Not About 9/11, which she performed in front of audiences in Philadelphia and then later off-Broadway. And, you know, she's one person who by her play, raised some more questions for people because she focuses her play on being one of thousands of people who were invited to come to the 9/11 museum and tell a story about their loved one. And in the play, off stage is the museum interviewer who only wants to know about what a wonderful person her dad was and the sad story of how he died. But what she wants to also do is talk about her mother, Lori Van Auken, and the other courageous family members that wanted to have an investigation, talks about how important the questions are, and says to the interviewer in the museum in her play that one of the best ways to honor the lives of those who died is to ask these questions and to speak for the dead since they can't speak for themselves anymore.
You have a statement by Donna Marsh O'Connor, who is mother of Vanessa Lang Langer, who's 29, and she died at 9/11. And the mother's statement is, "I feel frankly abandoned. If I question anything about the official story, I am called a conspiracy theorist." This was not what these women that initially started the action wanted to do. They wanted answers about their family members who were gone. There were too many discrepancies. And in Unanswered Questions, your book, Ray, you address so many of these aspects. You also make a statement about a publication that came out called The New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin, and how he pointed out something that I know most Americans are not aware of, that the CIA had not communicated with the FBI. All of these agencies that had information in advance, and yet nothing was done. And this really presents a very, very upsetting amount of information. And the comment about how the Al-Qaeda leader, Osama bin Laden, was the most wanted criminal, that was blasted all over the news all the time. But he was in an American hospital in Dubai in July of 2001 and was visited by a CIA agent, Larry Mitchell. I mean, just that one component, then you go, what's really going on here? What is going on behind closed doors, and why is it not being brought forth into the public? What is going on?
Yeah, I know so much of this story. I think about Christmas and with my cousins, and we would often be given, whether in San Diego or Alberta, Canada, a puzzle, maybe 500 or 1,000 pieces by one of our aunts or uncles, and all the cousins would get together and try and work on it between Christmas and New Year's. But so often, the story like September 11th and all the pieces, it's more like a 50,000-piece puzzle, so I can understand why some people just give up. But I think it's an important story, and it's important to remember, too, the accusation about conspiracy theory is simple on its face, but it's wrong in its value because the government itself offered up a conspiracy theory where two or more were gathered together to do something criminal and nefarious. I don't know anyone personally who said that they think that one person acting alone was responsible for the attacks on September 11th. And so it becomes a bit of a trick. It's like when I was in elementary school in grade three, and during recess, somebody from a clique in the group in the classroom would come over to me and say, "Your epidermis is showing." And I, being embarrassed and not knowing what the word epidermis meant, didn't realize that they were saying that your skin is showing, because, of course, their hands and face were also visible. So I think we need to get past the name calling and honor the family's questions and sit with them.
I agree. There is a statement in your book, and it is a very profound one. Democracy depends upon accountability. This requires citizens being able to distinguish truth from falsehood. In order to be able to tell the truth from falsehood, there must be a social agreement that truth matters. If the ground of democracy is truth, the ground of autocracy, is assertion. In an autocratic state, reality belongs to those who have enormous power to dominate and control others, including access to information. And our country is dealing with that right now. It has become a point where many people don't even want to watch the news because they do not feel that they're going to be told the truth. And your book, Unanswered Questions, and this is 2001, we're in 2021. Here we are 20 years later facing dilemmas again because of a lack of accountability, a lack of transparency, the buzzword that's often used but is not honored and respected. And we, as citizens of this country and any free country, that is primarily important, to be able to feel that you can trust those information resources, and it's a hard thing to do. Your book, Unanswered Questions, is so powerful. And Ray McGinnis, it is a book, when one reads it, it raises so many questions, not just about 9/11, but also about a lot of things that we're experiencing even in today's world. I want to thank you so much for being my guest. Now, you have a website called unanswered questions.ca, Charlie Adam. And people can be in touch with you if there's anyone that has a relative or is associated with that experience in any way. Would they be able to contact you through your website?
Yes, they could, and I have answered. Not only do I answer questions, I answer emails.
Well, that
they can,
is.
They can also get on my website. They can also get links to Amazon or Barnes and Noble, or they can order my book paperback or hard book through any local bookstore.
Well, it will be fascinating to see if there will ever be an honest investigation. There are so many questions that are brought up from the book, Unanswered Questions. It is really quite a profound read. Thank you, Ray McGinnis, for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Herbert Hoover said, "A splendid storehouse of integrity and freedom has been bequeathed to us by our forefathers. In this day of confusion, of peril to liberty, our high duty is to see that this storehouse is not robbed of its contents." Those words were written a long time ago, but they bear hearing again in today's world of confusion, concerns about personal liberties, and what do we do to take care of them.
This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.